You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to episode 94 of the podcast On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the people who play them. My name is Ran Aviram.
And my name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello!
And today we'll talk about fishing and classics, two things that one might not think about when they think about role-playing games. What is fishing, Uri?
Well, for the purpose of this podcast,
yes,
and
yes,
role-playing games in general, but not in any other context, we refer to fishing as taking the good stuff, be they form or content, and remixing or remodeling or re-whatevering them in order to put them in your game. Basically, we're talking about fishing for inspiration, fishing for ideas, taking something good out of the whole sea of something else and using that.
Exactly. Many people refer to it as stealing. I steal that plot point from whatever, or I stole that character from... But you don't steal them. They are still there. even if you'd love to steal Romeo from Romeo and Juliet, you can't. He's in Romeo and Juliet. But you can fish for the concept of Romeo, and you can take that and make it your own in your own way and have your own amazing filet Romeo to have for dinner.
Some people also refer to this as copying or plagiarizing, and both of these have somewhat of a negative connotation, which I think is ill-deserving when we talk about role-playing games. Taking a character or a plot idea from a classic is not plagiarizing. At least, not if you're not doing it commercially.
Even not commercially. If you make a fan fiction and you claim that Romeo is your own and new and original invention, you are definitely plagiarizing. To say nothing about what happens if you do so in academic circles. But this is your game. And there really shouldn't be any negative connotation to getting good stuffs from the classics, which are classics for a reason. They are filled with good stuff. And using them. That's the whole process of getting better at something, isn't it?
Definitely. Learning from the masters. So what we plan to do in this episode is to go over some of the elements you can fish from a classic and show you how it can be done.
Uri will use Romeo and Juliet as an example because he's such a sucker for Shakespeare.
And Ran will use Treasure Island because he's such a sucker for pirates.
Yar.
Let's start with talking a bit about plot and plot elements. Now, in Romeo and Juliet, I hope you're familiar with the basic plots, we have two rival houses with forbidden love between the offsprings of each. They fall in love, they run away, blah, 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 they are fortune's fool, and then they die. Sorry if that's a spoiler for you. It really shouldn't be by this point. Now, the plotline of Romeo and Juliet doesn't even have to be your main plotline. I wanted my party to track down two characters. So I instantly decided that these two characters would be a Romeo and Juliet from another story. He was a brave knight from the Order of the Dragon Riders, and she was a water lily vampire from the vampires of that forest. And of course, they're two organizations which are greatly at odds, but they fell in love and decided to elope, and now there's a bounty on their heads from both sides. And that's it. That's how I stole the plot of Romeo and Juliet and used it simply to have two lovers on the loose to give my party a plotline to follow. And when they caught them, there was this whole interesting ordeal in which our Romeo, and I'm doing air quotes here, pretended to be a fearless dragon rider who captured this vampire and taking her to justice and trying to deceive the characters so they won't steal his Juliet from him. For me, this is a good example of how you can totally fish a plot element and use it independently of the rest of the story.
Yes. Also note how Uri used it not as originally intended. So the original plot is about two characters and their love story and tragedy, etc. But here, they are used differently by Uri to motivate the players to do something. And then when the players encounter them, the fact that these two went through a plot makes for an interesting dilemma and situation, but that's not what the players played through.
It's very interesting because after the player characters got this Romeo and Juliet and they caught them, and now they have to decide to which house do they return them, or do they just, you know, cross them and give each to the other house. There was an interesting moral dilemma here, which was very easy for me to make up and play because I have all this beautiful background written by this great guy, you know, Shaky, and he really put a lot of emphasis on characters and relationship, and I don't have to do anything.
My example comes from Treasure Island, which is an interesting book. I think I haven't read it. I watched adaptations of it several times. I highly recommend Treasure Planet, which is an animated movie by Disney. And I think it's pretty cool all around and really nice. And it's basically just Treasure Island in space. And the main thing about Treasure Island is there's this boy. He gets a map. They get on a ship with some unscrupulous people. They get to Treasure Island, which I believe is called Skull Island, and there's a mutiny on board, and they meet someone who was stranded on the island for some time, and the map and some people change places and change allegiances, and everything changes all the time, and eventually you get the treasure, and the bad guys, well, were they bad or were they just very selfish? It's sort of awesome the way that the story is all about basically backstabbing. And what I learned about it is that it's not about finding the treasure. It's about competing to find the treasure. The second and third acts are all about this. During the second act, you learn about how there is going to be a mutiny. It's super duper clear from the start. We'll get to it later when I talk about characters, that it's going to happen anyway. And that's fine. That's part of the point. My players, when we are currently playing in a 50 Fathoms campaign, which is very much inspired by Treasure Island, they knew from the beginning there are going to be mutiny. We said so in our managing expectation forms. We want to have some mutinies around.
So, are they the mutineers or the mutinee?
They were both. Eventually.
A lot of backstabbing there.
A lot of backstabbing. So I used what Treasure Island taught me about how to implant the feeling, the dread of something coming. And more importantly, staying gray throughout. Because once you have a mutiny, if the mutineers are just plain evil, well, the only thing to do is to kill them and that's it. And we're done. But then there's no back and forth. Then there's just the final fight against them and it's over. But that's not what pirating is all about. At least pirate stories. I'm going to assume that in real life piracy, it is what it's all about. But in pirate stories, what you want is to have several competing people that are using politics, and we'll get to that again later when we talk about organization, to overcome each other and gain the power. That's an amazing, strange plot when you think about it, because it's supposed to be a book about finding some treasure.
It's much in the same way that the heist plot is not about the heist.
Yes.
It's about the planning, about getting the crew back together. It's about the reason why we're doing this heist, etc., etc.
Yes.
Let's move on to locations. Now, Romeo and Juliet takes place in Verona. I can't tell you how many times I have run games in Verona. It was never the actual Verona. And what do I mean by that? Romeo and Juliet's Verona has a city with a very simple structure. We have one prince who rules the city and everyone must listen to him. Point. We have two main patriarchal families that control most of the city, complete with guards and minions and whatnot. Point. We have the church, who simply tries to stay out of trouble and try to please everyone. And there are also a few guilds in the city. We can see Harbalist there and some others. Now, just taking all these elements and the power relationships between them as a template, if you change some of the names, you have an instant interesting setting. Now, this setting is very good for some things and very poor for others. If you want to have an interesting, political, multifaceted campaign, this is a very bad setting for you. There's basically three political bodies, and the power relations between them is very clear. If you want to have something more interesting, you need more powerful groups with an unsure dynamics between them. However, if all you want is to have a city which is stable and good, but with the potential for disaster and mayhem, this is an excellent setting. Once each one of the sides of the two main families gain an advantage, and they're always looking for an advantage over the other house, something interesting happens. And pieces can very easily be the tipping point. So as a location, this is amazing. And if I want to switch things up, I want to have, like you've mentioned, I want to have this, but in future space, sometimes it's easier to fish from people who already did the fishing for you. When I wanted to have my Verona in a futuristic setting for a Starfinder game, I simply fished elements from the anime Romeo x Juliet, that is a retelling of Romeo and Juliet in Neo-Verona, located in an asteroids and involved flying dragon horses and magical trees and whatnot, and simply ran my game there. It's easier because you can take a lot of the visual imagery that usually create the feeling of a specific time and location. If in Verona we had canals, for example, like in Venice, we can now, in future Verona, add, I don't know, floating spaceships between the asteroids on which the houses reside, etc. So location, be they the grand one, like the city, or the smaller one, like the Capulet house, where, you know, there's an inner garden and a balcony for the balcony scene and a hall for the banquets. You have very instant, easily created locations because you know them. And if you pay close heed to the location in a classic, they will usually give you a hint of what you can do with them. If you have a banquet and an inner garden, that's a perfect setup for, okay, there's a huge party and you want to make a small intimate scene to the side of the party. This is the perfect setup. That's why Shakespeare used that setup. And you can too.
My location, again from Treasure Island, is not Treasure Island. It's the ship. I found it curious and strange. Well, our game was all about being on a ship because it was a pirate game, as mentioned before, and I wasn't unsure what to actually do with it. Is it just like a moving base? Are we supposed to have interesting interactions on the ship? So I went to, again, not exactly Treasure Island at the time, I've never actually read it, but things around it, and one of them, by the way, is Black Sails, an amazing, excellent, brilliant show on Amazon Prime that I highly recommend, and is very much inspired by Treasure Island. And they have a lot of things to say about what happens on the ship. The ship is a small world, it's its own world. While you're out at sea, that's everything you have, only the ship. And that's sort of interesting already. The fact that it's isolated means that there's very little room to go to, exactly the opposite of what Uri, what you just said about the big hall. If you want to keep secrets on a ship, that's going to be difficult. You're going to get to know other people. In Treasure Island, there's a very famous scene where Jim, the protagonist, with a boy, hides in a barrel of apples. And that's how he gets to hear about Long John Silver's mutiny, as Long John speaks with one of the other mutineers, and they talk about how they are going to do their stuff, and that's when he realizes Long John Silver is as bad as he looked from the minute he saw him, because he's such a dastardly character. And that can happen only on a ship. Well, maybe it can happen somewhere else, but on a ship, it must happen. You can't really keep secrets. It's the question of how long can I keep this hidden? And that's true for personal secrets as well. Your hindrances in Savage Worlds, when you choose a hindrance, if you want to keep it hidden, it's just a matter of time until it will rise up to the surface. Either because you have an enemy, either on the crew or from the outside world, or if you have some sort of hindrance that you're trying to hide, like you're short-sighted or something like that, someone will discover it. It will come up. It doesn't have to be one of the other player characters. I think it might be more interesting if it's an NPC, and then you create some interesting relationships. And the ship is all about interesting relationships in a very small, isolated space.
Now, we have a plot, we have a location. What about the grand organization inside that setting? Let me just put things in our list of assets, shall we? We have a ruling prince in Romeo and Juliet. We have two main families. We have a church and a guild. These can be easily converted to organization with tangible limits, power structure, and specific organizational goals, because they are very well defined in relation to one another. The ruling prince as an organization, as the ruling body of the city, is above all. The two families are side by side. They are equal in power, they hate each other, and they will do anything to gain an advantage, like we mentioned before. And the church is to decide. It's not part of the political game in this specific setting. As we've mentioned before, you can fish all of these to have a coherent city. You can fish just one or two of these. Why not, if you're playing a game and you want to have this interesting, strong family there, why not have one of the families from Verona who was exiled? Okay, so you come across the city of Dandelbrot. The main ruling city is the Gingang. And the Gingels are very much angry at old enemies, and they currently are on the lookout to amass more weapons and troops and magical items. And this is a good opportunity for you to try and sell your wares or try to rent out your services as adventurers or see what quest they have open. I don't have to make up this whole family and structure and whatnot. I have everything ready, I just need to change the name, and I have this amazing backstory about the family that had a huge rivalry, and then, by some sheer luck, the other side gained an advantage, and the prince of that city threw them out, and now they're eager to reclaim their rightful place in that other city. Amazing backstory! And what did I do for that? Nothing!
So, for my organization, I will talk about pirates, amazingly. But
pirates?
Specifically, pirate crew, which is something I did not realize is an organization. Again, Black Sails was my inspiration here. And it showed from the first episode how a crew is, in a way, more powerful than the captain, and yet the captain is all-powerful. It's a very strange interaction between the two. But pirates used to vote about their captain and about their first mate, who represented them. And they used to vote on what they're going to do, and they used a very complex system of shares so that each of them got a fair share of any treasure that they stole cold-heartedly from other people.
Fished?
That's literally something. And it's all about power struggles. And throughout the first season of Black Sails and afterward, a lot of the time is spent on seeing how the captain tries to keep his vision and order and force the crew to do what he wants them to do using politics. Because that's what being in power is all about. And that's not different in a pirate crew. Maybe it's more complicated in a pirate crew because there is no outer authority like the police or something that you can bring in and use laws and government.
On the plus side, there's no outer law like the police that can accuse you when you kill the crew who mutinied.
Yeah. And so, of course, it's very dangerous. Everything is more dangerous because of it. And I stole that directly into my game, and it created very interesting situations because, again, you can't just say, they're the baddies, we'll destroy them. In just the last session, people who are, for all intents and purposes, pirates, even though they just said, yes, we relinquish our piracy days, 13 ships will join your navy of the British East India Company and will fight with you against other pirates. Everyone is aware that they are still pirates. Everyone is waiting for them to backstab. But what then happened is we took the main force behind them, their leader, a captain who was the one that they all listened to, and we used an excuse, a clever excuse, to force her to not be around during the big attack. So she was in a place where she could not take back her previous promise, and yet she could not be there to do the backstabbing during the big attack. And that was politics. It was amazing. It was awesome.
Speaking of awesome captains, let's talk about characters. Now, in Romeo and Juliet, there are a lot of characters, but let's just name a few as archetypes. Okay, we have the Lord Capulet, the father, the powerful patriarch of the family, who's abusive toward everyone and shouts at everyone and have to have his will taken into consideration, and if someone disobeys him, oh, he will rue the day, etc. This is an amazing archetype to take whenever you need a powerful and instantly hated character and put it into play. You have Mercutio, the crazy yet very loyal friend with the sarcastic tongue who keeps everything witty and lighthearted, and so when he dies, we all have a little heartbreak. You have Romeo, the naive child lost in adolescent love, amazingly privileged, son to one of the most powerful families in the city, and yet, oh, 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 mumbling all day. God, I hate him. You have the maid, Juliet's maid, which is an amazing comic relief NPC that is, on the one hand, really lovable and wants to help, but on the other hand, speak in the most TMI way possible. We have someone who talks openly about sex in every conceivable way next to a 13-year-old virgin girl who has no idea. And she doesn't do it due to anything bad. She just can't understand that some people might find that amazingly offensive. And if you don't have an NPC like that, just put one in. Everyone will either love or hate them, and getting that strong emotions from your players is priceless. We have Tybalt, the antagonistic, overly zealous asshole, which is just there to annoy everyone. Whenever I need my players really angry, I put a Tybalt in, and he simply stands there and, you know, say one of those Tybalt lines about how they're tiny, insignificant something, and he can pounce on them like a cat, but in a good way, not in a bad, cattish way, because he's a manly man like a cat, but not a little cat, a big cat, like maybe a lion or a jaguar, or how big this tiger gets, but cats, yeah! One of those, you know, the real asshole. Now, whenever I need one of these characters, I simply fish them out, and I usually try to fish a movie version of a character. That way, I have both a visual image, or an accent, or a certain body posture that I can work with when I play that character. This is a lot of ready-made stuff that we get, and it's easier to keep in your head. You're simply thinking, oh, okay, Count Decker, he's the Tybalt for this scene, and he's the Tybalt from the Romeo plus Juliet version with Leonardo DiCaprio. So he has this tiny mustache, and he speaks with a tiny voice, and he's so annoying because he speaks like this, and he keeps giving cats metaphors, and he's talking, and maybe he's rolling his R's a bit, just because he can, and he's looking at them, and he has this little cigarette, and he's looking at the cigarillo, and he's looking at them. And
as for my characters... I would like to talk about only two, specifically Long John Silver, of course, and Ben Gunn. Everyone knows Long John Silver. He's the epitome of the pirate ideal. He has only one leg, and he has only one eye, and he has a hook, I think, maybe, and a parrot, perhaps. It doesn't really matter. The main thing about him is the moment you see him, the moment he enters the story, you know he is bad news. He is obviously dangerous. However, he enters the story in a non-threatening way. He's the cook. He's just the cook on a ship that is manned by, well, there are several other unscrupulous people, but there's a good British gentleman captain, and the ship has a good reputation, and he's just a cook. And even worse, he's super likable. As the story continues, he gets very personal and very... kind, well, maybe not very kind, you can always see the cruel streak in him, but he is, generally speaking, kind toward Jim, our protagonist. So you see that he's a person, he's not a caricature. And, as dangerous as he might probably be, you really have no good reason to confront him. You can't just push him off the ship. You know bad things are happening, and once they come, It's such a satisfying dramatic moment because you knew this is coming and now it came. And that is a thing that is what drama is all about. So I definitely had several Long John Silvers in my game. We had one that the player knew from the get-go was everything about him was wrong. And we had one that from the get-go was in a situation where they took him in and suspected something about him is wrong. And they have one that became a running gag that he is going to betray them. He is Miguel. Miguel is definitely going to betray them. He's been betraying them in very tiny little amounts throughout the game. That's a running joke now. So when he will definitely turn against them during the final battle, players who listen to this, you know this is coming. Obviously this is coming. And that's fine. That's great. Not every betrayal needs to be behind the scenes. Long John Silver was going to betray you from the moment you saw him. The other character I really like is Ben Gunn. He's this dude that comes out of nowhere in the middle of the story on a deserted island. He's been there for who knows how many years. And he's both comedic and tragic at the same time. First, because he's comedic. He went a bit nuts. He is delusional. The only thing that he really, really wants is cheese. And that's really, literally, read it in the story. When he is presented with cheese, he finally reveals some vital information. However, it is also very clear why he is in this dire state, because he was abandoned here by the way, the same captain that Long John Silver walked under. So everything connects, and unfortunately for Ben Gunn, he lost most of his life, most of his adult life on this island. And that's very sad. However, he also really likes cheese, and that's very funny. So he's both things at the same time. And he becomes important to this story. And he becomes a lovable character. And he does all of this, even though he only enters the story around Act 2. Which is something I'm not used to. I'm used to thinking that I should place all of the main characters at the beginning, even if they only become main characters later. But this is not what happened here. And that really encouraged me, because then I allowed myself to put some Ben Gunns throughout the world. People that, as they encounter, I would allow them to become important. I would let the players decide if this is a funny, tragic Ben Gunn that deserves, you know, some place in their heart. And therefore, even though he came like last session, he can become someone important going forward.
In Romeo and Juliet, we have a myriad of relationships. People tend to remember, okay, this is a story about the relationship of forbidden love between kids from rival families. But rival families is another relationship. An abusive father and his daughter is a relationship. A maid and her young protege and the relationship between them is another relationship. And fishing a few elements together from a classic allow us to fish the relationship between them as well. And that create a much more believable scenario for our game, as well as make it easier for us, the GMs, to remember the dynamics between all the elements we have in our game. If I remember that, okay, I have this maid and I have this young daughter and I have here the father, and I already know the relationship between all of them. So if the PCs decide, okay, we want to talk to the maid, and they bribe the maid, and I need to check how feasible is that, I can do that because I know how terrifying the father is and I know what's the relationship between the maid and the young protege. So it's very easy for me to propel the game forward regardless of what the players are doing, because I know where all these characters are coming from and how they relate to each other. So I know that if they will offer the maid some dirt on the other family or some other element in town, I know that this family is all about power and politics. So that would be a good sell. But if they try to offer her money, for example, that's not a good sell, because she really loves her protege and loves working for that family and have endless loyalty toward them. And if the players decided to investigate, to gather some intelligence, they will learn all this. And it's very easy for me to give them this information, and it's very easy for me to remember that, because I know what the relationships between all these characters are.
In my game, there isn't really a lot to say about relationships. Most of everything is about allegiances, I think. So the question is, are we working together today or are we working against each other today? And that might change tomorrow. But that's basically it. So I have nothing else to add here.
Which is an excellent example of how different genres treat different elements differently.
Or maybe I'm missing something. That can be the case as well. And if you people at home think that I am missing something, send us an email to show@dwarfcast.net or even go to Facebook or Twitter @dwarfpodcast and tell us, what am I missing? Or, you know, tell us about your own fishing experiences. Which classics or non-classics you chose to as your source of inspiration, your lake of fishing from which you fished your best or just some good material that you've been using.
Or to summarize, fishing is an excellent practice. Do it. It lets you create complicated scenarios for your campaigns and make it easier to remember and manage. Easy.
Indeed. And now it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of dwarves.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games and our personal lives. Uri.
Well, one of my sessions got cancelled because I was sick. But one of my sessions was not cancelled.
Because you were not sick.
In fact, that session was the campaign finale for my Pathfinder game. In the last 2.5 years, I've been playing The Curse of the Crimson Throne, which is a Pathfinder 1st Edition Adventure Path by Paizo, about the rise and fall? No, just the fall of the city of Corvosa. And after 2.5 years, we're done. It was a long finale session, but totally worth it. I have summarized it all in a GIF, so I will remember it for all posterity. And it's a strange feeling, you know, every time finishing a campaign, especially one as a player, and not as a GM, which doesn't happen to me often, is a very interesting feeling. I wrote down for myself a lot of life lessons which I've learned from this campaign. And we're planning on having session zero for our next campaign, which will also be a Pathfinder 1st Edition Paizo Adventure Path, because they're amazing. I don't
know. Which one?
Probably Second Darkness. It's mostly the GM call, because he played most of them and he's amazing and we trust his judgment completely. Mm. But one of the things we're going to do is meet up and create our characters together. That's one of my lessons from the previous campaign. I like it a lot more if the creation process is together. This is something that...
Sure.
In some games it's obvious, like Fate and Masks and other games. But in D&D and Pathfinder, there's no real need to do that. But I think they're missing out on something.
I think there is a need actually to do that, especially in Adventure Paths, because they are about a specific campaign, a specific story, specific setting. And it would really help if all of the players agree together on what they are playing.
In some adventures, in Curse of the Crimson Throne, for example, the GM told us way in advance that, okay, you're all playing characters with a deep affection for the city, which love the city, etc., etc., etc. But we didn't actually create the characters together. Each one did his own thing with his own connection to the city. And I think something got lost there. I think there's no substitute for the actual back and forth of everyone getting to know everyone's character as they are forming, rather than meeting them in-game. I think there's a magic there. It's the equivalent of watching an exposition or an establishing shot which let you know what the character is all about. I think it works best in role-playing games if it's done as the character is forming.
I actually talked a bit about what happened in my last session during this episode. So instead I talk about a different thing. As mentioned before, my adventure One Last Tribute is available on the DM's Guild. And I would like to read out a review that I got for it by Larry H., who is a longtime listener and actually mentions that he heard about adventures through our podcast. So thank you. I also discovered that we follow each other on Twitter after I posted the review online. But he posted it first, and he says that this is a nicely fleshed out dungeon with great descriptions and situations to play in. Thank you. Well worth the $4 cost. He also says that the fact that there's a numbered map and an unnumbered map is useful, and I very much agree. And I think if you provide a PDF, you should probably provide several versions and variations so you can handle it either as a GM or as a player or whatever. If you are interested in One Last Tribute, and you should be, then go to our links, or just search for One Last Tribute in the DM's Guild. You can also download the original, well, it's not an original, it's the originally published in English version in the one-page dungeon contest. That's available for free. You can download it as a one-page dungeon. It's the same map, more or less. So if you want to check out what is generally speaking going on before you commit your $4, I highly recommend you do so. There's a link in the show notes.
Woohoo! And we have managed to record another episode, Eran. Hooray for us. And as for you, dear listeners, Leitraot!
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo. And you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Your note about Long John Silver really reminded me of a Pathfinder campaign I played in, and we adopted a group of goblins, and their leader used to stay up all night looking at us sleeping while we had our guards on. And he was actually named Betraytray, which is apparently a famous goblin name. I don't know.
Sure.
Makes sense. Yeah, Betrayray.
On the